Good morning. Welcome to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldin, and this week I have Professor Patrick Prindle from Clatsop Community College. He has a PhD in psychology and teaches psychology and other classes about the brain. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Ann.
All right. So we are going to talk about coping with stress, and I think it's great. We're going to start with things that don't really work very well.
Right, yeah, and before I launch into that, though, let me just say a quick hello to my friends, colleagues, and students at the college, and also to give the listeners out there a heads up that the material we're about to engage in is included in a class that I teach on a regular basis called Psychology 101, The Psychology of Human Relations, so if anybody's interested in signing up for that class after hearing today's program, they can certainly do so.
Great. Is it offered every term?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that's great. And you don't have to be a degree-seeking student.
No. Nope,
anybody can take it.
Just come by and take it because you just want to take it and learn more about how to manage stress.
That sounds great. And also at the station, Kate Brister, the Master Gardener, on the phone is here. If you have any questions for her, you can give a call. And also, if you miss anything in today's program or any program, you can go to coastradio.org and go to the archives and download a podcast and listen to any of the public affairs program on KMUN at your leisure. And they're listed by topic and date and program. You'll be able to find whichever ones you're looking for. Okay, so let's start talking about strategies that don't really work.
Yeah, well, the first one is giving up.
Yeah, that sounds like a given.
Giving up, yeah, it sounds obvious, but there's a concept that we talk about in psychology called learned helplessness. And learned helplessness can actually be stimulated in a lab. If you put a laboratory animal in a cage and administer a mild, not a harmful, but a mild electric shock, and set it up in such a way that the animal really has no way to escape. But then later you set up a mechanism like a door that they can push open or a barrier to jump over. And in the midst of the shock, they'll just lay there and do nothing. And that's called learned helplessness. So it also applies to we humans. If we've been exposed to stimuli of an aversive nature and we haven't been able to really get free of that.
Like a sometimes kid in an abusive home and they can't go and live somewhere else.
Good example.
They give up.
Good example.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a little deeper than you might think at first. Also, it relates to giving up, also relates, could be learned helplessness, also relates to what's called by some cognitive psychologists as a pessimistic explanatory style. One of the early pioneers in this kind of stuff was Aaron Beck at the University of Pennsylvania Med School. But anyway, if you have a pessimistic explanatory style and these aversive things happen to you, you have a tendency to blame yourself a little too much.
Oh, right, right.
Woe is me, here it goes, another thing is happening to me.
And of I might course, as well just, I'm the one that lost my job. I'm the one who the relationships fall apart.
Might as well just give up. Not much I can do about it. So notice that there's a key aspect in this feeling of loss of control, or there's not much that I have as far as decision making to make it different. So that's the first one, giving up.
Okay.
Probably not a good option.
Not a good option.
Yeah. Second one is acting aggressively.
Oh.
Kind of at the other end of the continuum. And kind of interestingly here, a deeper look at this one reveals that if you go into the history of psychology and recommendations that psychologists make about how to handle anger and aggression, it used to be this concept that was invented by Freud called catharsis was adhered to pretty much by most psychologists in the field. Catharsis means if you express your anger, there's this kind of a release, it sort of goes away and the
right,
tension reduces.
Mm-hmm.
And that does happen temporarily, but the research, there's a growing body of research that shows that quite the opposite. The more you practice expressing your anger, the better you get at it. Just like anything else.
Oh, so you don't feel better, you just get more angry.
Well, you may feel better temporarily, but again, the next time some stressful event comes your way and you act aggressively, you're going to be even better at expressing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we're going to see here in a minute, lots of research to show that anger and hostility highly correlated with coronary heart disease, high blood pressure, even myocardial infarction. So, yeah. And also watching research is clear, watching violent cartoons on TV, playing violent video games, anything that encourages you to think more violently will lead to acting more violently. So aggression is probably not a good option. So that's number two.
Okay.
So number one, we don't want to give up. Number two, we don't want to act aggressively. Those things don't work too much. Third one, another one that sounds like, fairly obvious, but worth pointing out, indulging yourself. We have these terms like emotional eating. So indulging yourself could be what? There's a lot of examples. Could be food, could be beverage.
I'm going to eat a whole half a gallon of ice cream.
Absolutely. I'm going to go get a pint of Ben and Jerry's, Cherry Garcia, and eat the whole darn thing, and then I'll feel better. And again, you do get that short-term benefit, but long-term, what are the prices you pay for this indulgence? And interestingly enough, there's a new kind of indulgence on the scene because of the technological era, and that is internet addiction. In fact, I have my students, part of their assignment is they have to do a series of questionnaires in the Psych of Human Relations class. And one of those is an internet addiction test. So they can kind of get a handle on, am I spending too much time in front of the computer? You know, because
it's so easy.
Well, it is. It makes a great servant, but not a very good master. So, yeah. So overindulging yourself, whether it be food or beverage or drugs or internet or
sex,
whatever,
anything,
probably not a good option. The next one that is of limited value would be blaming yourself. So this kind of ties in with what I said before, but Albert Ellis, who's a very well-known and sort of become an icon in the history of cognitive psych, Ellis has this term called catastrophic thinking. Catastrophic thinking, turning molehills into mountains. So you're not only just blaming yourself, but this small thing happens to you, an event happens that's fairly small, and you make it bigger and more important than it actually is. So that's also one of limited value, because if you turn everything into a catastrophe, the sort of like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening to me sort of thing.
And we can all think of people who do this.
Absolutely. In fact, I would think all of us, it isn't so much that I'm saying that we don't do these things, because I think all of us sometime or another uses any and all of these things. And the key is, again, that they do have a temporary benefit usually. You eat the Ben and Jerry's, you feel better.
Well, for 10 minutes.
You just give up and go take a nap and you kind of feel, you don't have to worry. You check out for a while and so on. So they do kind of have some value, but notice limited value in terms of long-term effectiveness. So then another one is using defense mechanisms to shield against emotional discomfort. Using defense mechanisms to shield against emotional discomfort. And the key term there, of course, is emotional discomfort. So we might want to spend a little time on that. People that have a kind of belief system that says, in order for me to be happy, things must be pleasant and my emotions must be positive all the time, I think have a kind of an unrealistic outlook on what life is. There are times when we're required to kind of suffer a bit. You know what I mean? I mean, in order to get projects done, my students can vouch for this.
Well, right. You have to put in the time. You have to put in the work. You have to maybe get tired, work beyond what you're comfortable. But everyone who has a job knows that you have to work beyond what you're comfortable doing at times. I mean, if you have a 12-hour shift, the last 4 hours is probably going to feel pretty tough.
Exactly.
But you do it because it's your job, or you quit because you don't want to do it.
Yeah. So I guess the deeper level of this one is this avoidance of emotional discomfort. Sometimes the important thing is to face that discomfort and work it through. One of my favorite terms that Freud invented was that the only way around is through.
Okay.
The only way around is through.
So let's talk, give an example of...
A couple defense mechanisms?
Yeah.
Denial. That's a good one. You basically just go into denial mode. This isn't really happening. And all the defense mechanisms have one thing in common, and that is they provide temporary relief again, but what's the price? Distortion of the truth. You're not really seeing things clearly and realistically.
Mm-hmm.
And denial is probably a really obvious example of that. Fantasy might be another approach. Repression is when you basically just sort of stuff it. The example I use for repression, if people can relate to metaphor, I like to use a lot of metaphors, is the dog who runs off and buries his bone in the garden somewhere and then later on wants to go find it and can't, kind of thing. So you're stuffing it somewhere. Projection is when you basically do not own something that's not so pleasant about you, one of your characteristics, and you project it and see it onto another person.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of us do that.
Mm-hmm.
We see the undesirable, unwanted parts of ourselves and others.
I think so, that shows up a lot in dreams.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's a good point. In other words, the characters in our dreams...
The monster in the dream is a negative part of myself.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. You've projected that onto the monster in your dream.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in waking life, we do that actually with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Or displacement. There's another example. Displacement. You're upset with your boss, but it's not acceptable to express that, so you go home and kick the dog.
Mm-hmm.
I feel bad saying that, but, you know, sometimes that happens.
Well, people do. Oh, or they yell at their kids.
Or yell at their kids.
Or their spouse.
Or their spouse.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely a good example. And so what's that called?
Displacement.
Uh-huh.
You know, and instead of directing that, of course, what you should do, if you go back to what I suggested before about acting aggressively, if you're feeling angry and upset, find ways to cope with that other than expressing it directly. But in this case, what happens is they don't express it directly at the time, but later on, someone else gets it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. And usually it's a surprise.
Right, yeah. And probably not appropriate.
Reaction formation is another example. And the best example I can think of reaction formation is, I've heard people say this, parents, like a child may fall and skin their knee or something, and they say, now just put on a happy face. Reaction formation is the idea that you try to present to the world the opposite of what you're feeling. And that can provide some temporary release. There's some pretty good research to show that. Again, I guess a common theme here is that many of these approaches that are of limited value, again, the keyword's limited, are things that we engage in repeatedly because they do have some value, usually in the immediate aftermath of, mm-hmm. of using them. You know what I mean? But long term, mm-hmm. probably not so good. So in this case, in reaction formation, what you're doing is protecting against having to feel that negative stuff by putting on a happy face, and it can work temporarily. You really don't want to go to the meeting. Oh, I'm really dreading this meeting. Oh, God, I really don't want to go. So you go in the men's room or women's room, whatever the case may be. You look in the mirror. You do what I like to call the flex and wink routine. You put on a little happy face and say, go get them. And you go in there and you put a smile on your face and you can get through a meeting you don't want to be at for a couple hours, usually by using that technique. So it can work.
But that's not a bad idea. I mean, if you have to be there, that's a great idea. But if that's
absolutely.
But if you never deal with whatever it is, maybe you hate the boss,
yeah,
like getting a new job or finding a way not to be in that meeting or maybe to have more control in that meeting, you're not going to be very happy.
Well, that's the essential point. They can have some temporary value and, mm-hmm. and maybe should be used from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
But long term, yeah, if you've got an issue with somebody at the meeting and you're not dealing with that you're then you're engaging one of the ones with limited value, which is to what? Give up. So you're giving up and going away.
Mm-hmm.
Or you may be going off and overindulging, eating the Ben and Jerry's.
Right, as soon as the meeting's over, I'm going to have that ice cream.
Absolutely.
Or I'm going to have two scotch and soda right off the bat.
Exactly. So, yeah, so I put on a happy face to get through the meeting, and now I'm going to go have Ben and Jerry's. Mm-hmm. And then when my anger comes out of my boss, I'm going to displace and have an argument with my spouse.
Right.
You know, so you can string them together, too. That's also an important point.
Right, and then you're ruining your relationships in other places.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And notice what happens there is everything starts to compound. And what does that do? Creates more stress.
Mm-hmm.
So you get caught in this kind of sort of tumbleweed effect where you're rolling along, creating more stress because you're using these techniques of limited value. And then you keep using the limited value ones, which creates more stress. And you're caught in this sort of endless.
And you end up with lousy relationships at home, at work, maybe lose your job. Things could spiral out.
Things just go from bad to worse.
Have we gotten through number five?
We have. We've gotten through most of the ones. I have some other examples, but I think we can... let me just say rationalization is also a common one, and we'll move on. But rationalization is a defense mechanism that a lot of people use, again, that has temporary value, limited, but value. In other words, you have something you really, really want, a goal you want to achieve,
mm-hmm.
something you want to purchase or that sort of thing, and for some reason it falls through. So the typical response is to what?
I didn't really want it anyway.
There you go.
Yeah.
So again, it can
we're good
work.
At that. Yeah,
we're good at that. Notice the distortion in these things.
Right, because we did want it.
We did want it. We did want it.
Right, and we still want it.
And we still want it.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a break. We come back. We'll talk about coping strategies that do work, that are successful. If you have a question, you want to join the conversation, or you want to talk to Kate about a gardening problem or question, give us a call here at 325-0010. You're listening to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldin with Professor Patrick Prindle, and we're talking about coping with stress.
Well, there's a certain girl I've been after a long, long I can't reveal her name until I get her. Most say yay, encore, encore, encore. Many fini are the Yankees on me, and I said that we more lame at London. And I said that we more lame.
You're listening to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldin, and I'm with Patrick Prindle. He's a professor of psychology at Clatsop Community College, and we're talking about coping with stress. So we were talking about things that don't work. So let's talk about some of the strategies that
work. Yeah, let's give our listeners some options here that may work more effectively.
Good.
Notice I'm saying may, and people can pick and choose what feels comfortable with them, of course.
And you get better at things the more you do them.
Absolutely. It's like practice makes perfect. So mm-hmm. if you decide you don't want to be aggressive and express anger, you can come up with some alternatives. And if you practice those, well, you'll get better at those as well.
Absolutely.
So constructive coping falls under three primary approaches. The first is appraisal, what are called appraisal-focused strategies. The mm-hmm. second, problem-focused strategies. And then lastly, more emotion-focused strategies.
Hmm.
So appraisal, problem, emotion-focused. So we'll sort of go in that order.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's start with appraisal. What does that mean?
Okay. Well, appraisal means, let me just give you, start with it, and I think it'll become obvious. Detecting negative self-talk is one example of an appraisal. Now notice, if you're engaged in self-talk, and most of us are, the inner conversation that's going on in our head most of the time. If you're in a writing class at the college, by the way, most of the English profs are going to tune you into that and say, when you're writing something, please turn off the inner editor. Don't start editing your work until after you're completed. That's a form of self-talk.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of times that kind of self-talk gets in the way, as most of my writing colleagues there would support, I think.
Okay, so I can think of an example of self-talk would be, oh, I'm not even going to apply for that job. I'd be no good at that. They'd never hire me.
Absolutely great example.
Okay.
Absolutely great example. So detecting, now notice detecting and then trying to eliminate and come up with more positive self-talk.
Okay, so appraisal is really more of the evaluating yourself.
Yes.
Or your behavior. Oh, that was really an aggressive response. That really didn't get me what I wanted, or that wasn't the right place. Kind of going through unraveling the why behind the behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
How we label, how we think about things.
And then what do you do with that once you say, oh, God, look what I'm doing? Because there's another part to that, which is new behavior.
Well, there is, and that leads us right into the second one, which is rational thinking.
Oh.
So, you know, if we can start to eliminate some of the negative self-talk that we've detected and come up with more rational and positive alternatives.
So like the giving up or the denial or the blaming other people. So coming up with something that's
so even
different.
If you said something to yourself like, gee, this is really too bad that this happened to me, but you know what? I'm really a pretty good person. And I think if I kind of dig in and work on this, I can probably work my way through this. Would be an example of an alternative.
Uh-huh.
And really training yourself to catch that. Now, with some people, I call it rubber band therapy. One of the things you can do to develop more awareness of these internal dialogues is literally to wear a rubber band on your wrist. And every time you're tuned into that aspect of the negative self-talk, you snap the rubber band just to sort of wake yourself up and go, okay, I'm doing it again.
Mm-hmm.
And then have, if it's convenient, I suggest sort of having some written alternatives that you want to start putting in there, almost like programming your computer. and have them laminated and hang it on the rearview mirror of your car, put it on your car seat, put it on your bathroom mirror.
Refrigerator.
Put it on the refrigerator with a refrigerator magnet, et cetera. So you're encountering in a tangible way with these alternatives until you can internalize them.
So that means you have to like write down some of the things that you want to be saying to yourself.
There you go.
Which is like, I am not a loser, but I'm a winner.
Yeah. Right? And saying it that way, you know,
in the positive, not in the negative. A lot of times people will start to write new goals in the negative.
Yes.
I do not anymore.
Yeah.
Not that way. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. And then another one is positive reinterpretation. Something bad happens. Now, these are all appraisal focused.
Mm-hmm.
So something bad happens. And, there's an old saying, it's an ill wind that blows no good. It's an ill wind that blows no good. Or every cloud has a silver lining. Or sometimes I'll hear people say, let's make lemonade out of those lemons.
Mm-hmm.
All of those are good metaphors for the idea that almost every situation, one of my favorite, if I may tell a little story, a gal is on the way to work one day and she sees this little kid on a big pile of horse manure. And on the way home from work, like 8 hours later, guess what? The little kid's still out there in the big pile of horse manure. Well, this gal just can't believe it. She's really impressed with this kid's tenacity, stops the car, gets out and walks over and says, hey, I noticed on the way into work about 8 hours ago, you're up here shoveling this manure. What's going on? You've been here all day. And the kid goes, well, you know what? With a pile of horse manure this big, there's got to be a pony in there somewhere. So, you know, and that sort of, again, it makes the point that if we look, we can probably find something good in this mess and at least pull that out and have a little bit more balanced perspective.
So. Okay, we had a call and someone asked, how do we deal with family members? And it looks like they were taught when we were referring to projection and transference. I think, you know, what if the family member is the problem? Or what if the relationship with the family members, you know, the family's negative, the family says crappy things to us all the time. Oh, you're such a loser. You have such a lousy job. You do such a lousy job taking care of us or whatever they say.
Yeah. So they may be acting aggressively. They may be displacing. They may be projecting, not owning their own stuff. They may be doing a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we can't, unfortunately, I wish I had better news, but it's hard for us to really help someone else achieve insight, especially if it's our own family member.
Mm-hmm.
So the first recommendation I would have is to find a referee of some kind.
A referee?
A referee, a mediator,
you
know, someone that's sort of neutral.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, if you're going to talk about this stuff, I always recommend to do it in a neutral place. Get away from those emotionally laden places, like the kitchen table or in the living room or whatever. Go down to one of the local restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because if you're in a public situation, what is that going to do? It's going to inhibit the typical kinds of responses that might come out.
So to make it safer for everyone.
Yeah, make it safer for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one is run your own railroad as best you can, because if you're running your own railroad and being a good engineer in your own railroad, you may have a really positive role modeling effect.
You know, that is a good point. I noticed some really bad behavior coming out when I had my first daughter that I had experienced, a lot of hitting and yelling. And I thought, well, this isn't me. Why am I doing this? And of course, you know, when you do that, when I did that, my husband would yell, my daughter would, you know, we're all yelling and hitting. Everything is yucky. And I did some work on me and stopped doing that. It all disappeared in the whole family. Everything calmed down.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to say, you need to stop doing that. You cut that out. You need to be different. I changed and everything in the family calmed down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without my saying anything.
Yeah. Excellent example of that recommendation. Absolutely.
So while we can't change them by, you need to change, they're going to go, you need to change. Give
leading
me a break.
Leading by example.
Right.
You know, even, you know, leaders and organizations and stuff, leading by example, they get the troops to follow them a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you ready for another one?
I am ready for another one.
How about humor?
Humor.
I just used a little humor, and that's one of my favorite coping strategies, and most of my colleagues and students will vouch for that.
Uh-huh.
I like to use humor. I like to have fun in my classes. I have high standards, and I make my students work hard, and they'll all attest to that as well, but we also have fun in there. So if we're learning and working toward becoming better people and having fun at the same time, that's a pretty good class, and I think that's true of life, too. So trying to, you know, doing your best to find those areas of life that you really can laugh at. And sometimes when we're stressed out and things aren't going well, and we feel like we're just sitting, this is one of my favorite metaphors, we're just sitting in a big Yoplait container of yogurt. You know, we're just in some serious yogurt, that sometimes you can just sort of get that image and start laughing and going, well, you know, today I'm sitting here in this serious big pile of yogurt, but tomorrow's a new day and I'm not a bad person, and, you know, find a way to laugh at it.
Mm-hmm.
Or hang around other people that have good senses of humor that can help you get that sort of attitude about things.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe it really isn't that bad.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's not. You know, one of the things when you bring up humor that I think of is sometimes people use humor in a really negative way. They make fun of other people.
Well, that's hostile humor, and I don't recommend that. I'm glad you brought that up.
Okay.
We distinguish in psychology, due to the work of Abe Maslow primarily, between hostile humor,
mm-hmm.
and there's usually hostile humor is at someone's expense.
Mm-hmm.
Sexist jokes, ethnic jokes, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff, putting someone else down, laughing at people, no. Because that's not really humor. What is really behind that? It's really a disguised expression of hostility.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks for bringing that up. What you want to do is use philosophical humor. That's the key term. Philosophical humor.
Like the pony. Mm-hmm.
Philosophical humor. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Nobody's getting hurt. Nobody's being insulted.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. I mean it. That's a really important distinction. And then last, under appraisal focused, is turning to, in a positive way, turning to religion. So, you know, finding a wisdom tradition that works for you, getting into meditation, doing spiritual reading. I know in my office, I have a little book called The Mystical Hours, which are just little short sayings from people like, oh, the Dalai Lama or Thomas Merton or whatever, that I can start my day off with and just read this thing and then reflect on it, just even for a minute,
mm-hmm.
just to sort of set a tone. So. Mm-hmm. So a positive relationship with whatever religion or spirituality you may have. And we're getting close enough, so we want to move on and see if we can get through a couple of problem.
Yeah.
Let's do like one problem and one emotion focus, and then go back and
okay.
see if we can just hit a couple of them. So one problem focus strategy is to engage in seeking social support.
Oh. Don't just sit home and feel bad about it, whatever's going on.
Ask for help.
Uh-huh.
Not even, and you don't even have to ask for help necessarily, but we're not in this deal alone. So one of the real good problem-focused strategies is to have friends and mm-hmm. be involved in groups and go hang out with them.
Mm-hmm.
And gosh, does that help? There's a lot of research on that. People that have good social support networks tend to do better when they're coping with stress.
Cool. That's great.
And one emotion-focused one coming up,
mm-hmm.
we might have to do another program.
I think
so. We
don't
have time to finish this up. Anyway, so an emotion-focused strategy might be learning how to forgive others.
Mm.
Learning how to forgive others. And that is so good for the universe, I think, but it's really good for us because forgiveness, if we do it the right way, because we're upset, we've been violated, we've been betrayed, someone's treated us badly, and to sort of get through the negative emotions and own those, work them through. Remember, the only way around is through.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally come to that place where you can take a deep breath, and let go of it, forgive, and move on, because now you've released that stuff and you're moving on and you're not carrying it with you. And I think the community you live in is better for it, and you certainly are as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yet, when you're there and you're pissed off about something, it's really hard to think that that's going to be good.
Absolutely.
Because, damn it, they are not going to get away with
Absolutely.
This.
Absolutely. Well, what I always say, you know, forgiveness starts in the darkness and ends in the light. So, starts in the darkness and ends in the light.
That's great. Yeah, that's good.
So, we have time for one more, or what?
15 seconds.
Okay, how about exercising as a problem-focused...
There you go.
...or even emotion-focused coping strategy? Exercising, regular exercise, especially cardio, very good for stress.
That is great. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Ann. It's always a pleasure.
It's been To Your Health. I'm Ann Goldin, and I've been with Patrick Prindle. He's a professor of psychology at Clatsop Community College.